This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joshua Donovan, and today I'm delighted to welcome Sarah Gualtieri to the show. Dr. Gualtieri is an associate professor of American Studies and Ethnicity, as well as History and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California. Supported by fellowships from the National Endowment of the Humanities, the American Council of Learned Societies, and others, Professor Gualtieri has published several studies on the history of race, gender, and immigration, including her first book, Between Arab and White, Race and Ethnicity in the Early Syrian American Diaspora, and a co-edited volume entitled Women and Islamic Cultures, Disciplinary Paradigms and Approaches. But today we will be discussing her latest book, Arab Routes, Pathways to Syrian California, which was published in 2019 by Stanford University Press. Thank you so much for sitting down with us today, Professor Gualtieri.
You're very welcome, Joshua. It's a real delight to be in conversation with you this morning, and thank you for making time to speak to me and to talk about my recent book.
Absolutely. So could you please just briefly introduce yourself to our readers, and how did you come to write this book in particular?
Sure. I'll just add a little bit to your lovely introduction. I am an interdisciplinary scholar, which is probably obvious from the multiple units I'm attached to at the University of Southern California. I teach and advise students in American studies and ethnicity, in history and Middle East studies. I am a product of a wonderful program at the University of Chicago. I trained there in the 1990s. And my first job was actually at Loyola University in New Orleans, and I've been at USC since 2005. I came to write this book as a second project. So I had finished and published my first book, Between Arab and White, and I wanted to move on to what I thought would be a more contained project focusing on the location of Los Angeles, focusing on the early Syrian and Lebanese community in Los Angeles. As I began the research, most especially as I started on a set of oral histories, I soon realized that this idea that it would be a more contained book was pretty ill-conceived, and in a wonderful way, because I actually began to realize that there were ways for me to broaden conceptually the scope geographically and also archivally, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But I think a key moment for me in sort of shifting the analytical frame was when I was in conversation with a woman who was the daughter of Syrian and Lebanese immigrants to Los Angeles who had come in the early part of the 20th century. And she was describing how her father spoke Spanish to the woman she called the mother's helper, who was a Mexican young woman. And I said to my interlocutor, I said, "Oh, that's very interesting. Your father spoke Spanish." And she replied to me, "Oh, yeah, he was Mexican." And so I paused on that assertion because we just spent the previous half hour talking about, you know, him growing up in Lebanon and migrating to Los Angeles. And she had somehow in that first iteration of the interview left out the Mexican part. And as I probed more and asked her to develop the story of movement of her father, I found out that actually he had gone to Mexico and had spent many years working there and was a Spanish-speaking Arab who came to Los Angeles. And so I was interested in using this moment in my oral histories to think more broadly about what would it mean to write a history that placed the Mexicanness of many of the Lebanese and Syrians who came into Los Angeles at the center of my analysis, rather than just have it be kind of a tangential piece of information that even my interlocutors sometimes forgot to mention.
That's a fascinating story, and something that I want to push on a little bit more than the significance of centering a story away from the East Coast, right? Because for me, one of the most obvious contributions that this book makes is that it speaks to a pretty persistent gap, I would argue, in scholarship on Arab immigration to the United States, which is often centered on the East Coast and New York City in particular. There are, of course, some exceptions, but you take a different focus. And I want to just read a brief sentence of yours. I thought the wording was really entertaining to me. But you say on page 4, if we continue to think metaphorically of New York as the mother colony, then Arab Routes is interested in other kinds of family idioms, her unacknowledged lovers, her forgotten half-sisters, her surrogate daughters, and her renegade sons. So what do we gain by talking about some of those forgotten family idioms?
Yeah, I like that you pulled that sentence out because, you know, I struggled with the weight of the historiography on Arab immigration. I mean, struggled in the sense of wondering how I would both, as a scholar, acknowledge the wonderful contributions that so many historians, sociologists have made to this canon of Arab American history, how I would acknowledge and respect and honor that contribution, but at the same time argue that it was important. And I actually think it's urgent to move away from some of the epistemological blind spots of that scholarship. And so it's lovely to talk about New York as a mother colony for Arab Americans. It's a way of recognizing the importance of the city and its surroundings as an early place of congregation, of community building. But the problem has been that it's constant centering of the narrative of Arab immigration on the East Coast has obviously tended to undermine the other points of origin of communities, points of origin of movement, and also to, I think, quite dramatically efface the really transnational and even hemispheric component of the late 19th and early 20th century Syrian migration in and around the Americas. So I think I was trying to use different idioms. I think it's very important as for scholarship that is trying to move away from very established paradigms, that we offer language that can conceptually do that work for us. So I thought it's okay to preserve some of the family idioms, the relationships of motherhood, and but I thought, well, we can push a little bit further and think of other kinds of metaphors. I try to move away from botanical metaphors, oceanic ones. You know, I don't want to talk about you know, trees and soil and waves. I prefer to try to offer new metaphors, new idioms to develop my argument around the multiplicity and the multiple nodes of entry and the multiple points of origin for the Arab American narrative.
So in order to explore that multiplicity, as historians, we have to have some form of source material. And I think one of the reasons that the East Coast has been so covered is not only because of the importance, of course, of Ellis Island, right, and these notions of waves arriving on the shore are pretty common to a lot of histories of immigration, but also, you know, with Arab immigration specifically, there are a fair number of sources, particularly for the mother colony, right, or for New York. Several Arabic language newspapers have survived. Of course, people who don't even really work on Arab immigration have probably heard of literary figures like Khalil Gibran and Amin Rahani, who've left behind a lot for people to go through. There's, at least in my experience, there's a smaller source base or a more difficult source base to try to find Arab migrants who went to other places in the United States. So how did you go about trying to build a source base to tell these different stories outside of the New York City area?
I think that's a really nice way to put it, Joshua, that how did I go about building a source base? So I think one of the important ways that this book is different from my first book is that I realized fairly early on that if I was going to try to tell a different story about Syrian and Lebanese migration in the United States that pivoted away from the East Coast, that I was going to have to do exactly that, to build a source base, because I wasn't going to find it in a way that I think I could capture all the nuance that I wanted to in the established repository. So as you know, there's a wonderful collection, the NAF Arab American Collection at the Smithsonian. The Library of Congress has wonderful material, including microfilm of newspapers published in New York. So there is obviously wonderful archival thickness in New York and in Washington, D.C. And I think it's, you know, obviously important for younger scholars to access those repositories, and it's one of the ways that they can get funding to do their work. You know, the Smithsonian, for example, has a fellowship for the use of its collection. So it is important to use those established repositories, but the problem is that they have been, in a way, fetishized as like the only places where you can find historical documentation on the early Arab American community. So I began to really use the oral histories that I was conducting as a place where I could build my archival base, my source base. It was not uncommon for me to interview family members intergenerationally. So there would often be members of multiple generations in one interview, and they would bring to these sessions photographs, letters. It was a very fluid and exciting process for me, and I was often leaving these oral histories that I was conducting in people's homes, people's basements. I was leaving with material, and then I would bring it back, and they would give me more material. I remember really wonderful moment. I was at the St. Nicholas Antiochian Church in Los Angeles in their library in the basement. I was, according to the librarian, the first person to be using the library. And the librarian, Robert Andrews, started just to sort of pull things down and say, oh, you might want to look at this, you might want to look at that. And so I really loved that so much of the archival base of this book is the product of these kind of transactions that I had. I mean, archival transactions that I had with my interlocutors. And so I think it's a way of thinking about the constitution of an archival base that is dynamic and mobile. There is no repository, right? I have stuff in my study now. I have stuff that I've used and sent back to people, and so I actually think it's an exciting way to think about how archives don't have to be always deposited right in one place, that they can actually be moving around. And I can't wait for another scholar to come along and use some of the material I've used, added to it, and also create her own archival base.
It sounds on the one hand a bit daunting, but at the same time extremely exciting. And I love when having these conversations, particularly about Middle East studies, being able to think about a problem that so many people have, which is difficulties accessing materials in formal archives that one might readily draw on studying histories of other parts of the world. And so I admire that creativity. And I want to build on that a bit. One of the other things that you've used, in addition to this very rich and interesting set of archives out of which come these really interesting anecdotes in the book, but you also pull U.S. government sources as well, census records and things like that. And one of the early conclusions that you draw is that El Paso, in particular, El Paso, Texas, was a really important and often underappreciated hub of internal migration, right? One of the many pathways, for example, that you talk about in your book. Could you tell us a little bit about El Paso as a space of transit or a pathway?
Sure. I, like you, was surprised by this. And I did first uncover it. I'm not the only scholar, obviously, to write about El Paso. There's some really lovely work that's been done on medical inspection at El Paso in the early part of the 20th century that has discussed the place of Syrians in the medical inspection regime. So I knew that El Paso mattered in the story of the movement of Syrians from Mexico to the United States. But what I was not prepared originally for was the extent of the crossings, right? So the border crossings in the late 19th, early 20th century are just staggering, in the tens of thousands of people identified as Syrian moving across, back. So it's both a pathway, but it's also this, I think you use that word node, which I really like. It's this place of movement, right? That I think is helpful for us stretching the narrative of Arab migration to, obviously, to from the border area south, and seeing how the border, obviously, in this, especially in this early 20th century period, is a space of fluidity, right? And I think it's the focus on El Paso. It's a smaller piece of my argument in the book, but it's one that I hope can be developed by other scholars in more detail in relationship to a borderlands history. So I think this is yet another contribution of the book and to a set of conversations that are ongoing in Middle East mobility studies, a set of conversations around the importance of hemispheric frameworks, and really frameworks that sort of bust out of the nation state paradigms that tended to really ossify the study of migration for many decades. So in my original training, it was very common for those of us working on migration to identify our expertise in terms of a nation state framework. So there were the people who did, you know, Arabs in the US, the people who did Arabs in Mexico, Arabs in Brazil. And I think what we're seeing now in the scholarship is a real productive discussion on connecting those connecting the scholarship across nation states. And, one of the ways we have to do that is to be archivally creative and inventive, right? So we can't rely on the national repositories if we want to tell a story that is more focused on the movement across nation state boundaries. So I think some of the archival choices I made in this book have to do with that desire to really push against the boundedness of the nation state in the study of migration.
I think that's a really important contribution. And, especially in the 21st century, I think it can be hard. We tend to get into these nation state paradigms, right? You know, in particular, if you want to just take as an example the U.S.-Mexico border, it has become not only ossified, right, but so profoundly militarized that it can be difficult, I think, to go back to a time when that wasn't necessarily the case, right? So when I was reading just how many thousands of times the U.S.-Mexico border was being crossed by Syrian migrants in the 19-teens and 20s, I thought of Rachel St. John's work, right, A Line in the Sand, where she talks about the long history of the U.S.-Mexico border and recalls a time where the border was a lot more fluid, certainly, than it is today. And then one of the things that you do to build on that is you note that even though there is this sort of what one might call today transnational fluidity, there was also the emergence of racialized immigration regimes. And you talk about how Mexicanness, the kind of which that you sort of alluded to earlier, ends up complicating the racialization of Syrian immigrants. Can you speak to that a little bit and how these border crossings, right, or how time both in the United States and Mexico complicated how Syrians were identified by states at this time?
Yeah, I think this complicates. So seeing Syrian migrants, and I was focused particularly on migrants who ended up for a period of time in Los Angeles. Some of them went back to Mexico. Some of them moved to other parts of California. But I was interested in understanding how Mexicanness mattered to the racialization of Syrians. And so this is really an extension of earlier commitments I had and continue to have in my work, in which I argue for the importance of race as a category of analysis in the study of Arab migration. And I think I just have to assert again that this is still something that we need to, in a way, defend as historians. It was interesting for me as a younger scholar to see how there was, pushback in some areas of our field of Middle East studies, pushback to the idea that race mattered in the study of Arab migration, and not in a way that was sort of a knee-jerk response, oh, Arabs have been victims of racial discrimination, which of course is the case, but really to be probing in our analysis of race in the early Syrian American experience. So I have for a long time worked with the concept of betweenness that early Arab migrants, those especially from Syria or Greater Syria, moved in a space of in-betweenness between Asianness and whiteness, both participating in claims to white racial identity and the privileges that it afforded, such as the right to vote, the right to purchase property, but also ways in which Arab immigrants have pushed against identifying as white and refusing, in fact, at different junctures to participate in white supremacist logics. So I've been someone interested in continuing this conversation around the importance of race and racialization in our study of my Arab migration. And I wanted to acknowledge that when we ask the question, how did the Mexicanness of Syrian migrants in Los Angeles, how did it matter? I wanted to do so in such a way that didn't claim that Syrians were who had come from Mexico were necessarily Mexican in the same ways that communities, longstanding communities of Mexicans in Los Angeles were Mexican, but there was a way in which they participated in the production of Mexican ethnicity. They had children who were born in Mexico who were always primarily Spanish-speaking, whose friends were also Mexican. And the community formation we see is one that is more hybrid, right? So I wanted to use some of the concepts of hybridity and even of mixture, of mestizaje, to think about Syrian racialization. That is sort of moving in a direction away from what the whiteness paradigm and complicating the Asianness of Syrian racialization.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, further complicating the racialization of Syrian immigrants, you also talk about in the second chapter in particular, the rise of inter-ethnic solidarities, particularly between Syrian migrants and other Latino migrants to Southern California. And at the same time, you also present a newer sort of interesting methodology to trace one figure through various archives and moments, not to sketch out a complete biography of sorts, but to make a broader analytical point. And so the figure that I have in mind that you do this with is George Shibley, a prominent defense attorney in Los Angeles. Could you tell us a little bit about Shibley and how he illustrates the kind of inter-ethnic solidarities that you were talking about in the book?
Sure. So this was, in a sense, an ironic surprising move for me to make methodologically, given some of my earlier refusals to do what I thought would be great, the history of great men in my work. And so you're right that I do use or trace the connection of George Shibley, who was one of the lead defense attorneys in the in People versus Zamora, which was popularized as the Sleepy Lagoon case, in which a group of young Mexican American men were brought up on charges for murder that were trumped up, and the trial was a real travesty of justice. They were not allowed; the young men were not allowed to bathe. They were denied counsel, and they were charged. Several of them were charged with the murder of another young Mexican American man, Jose Diaz, and they were sent to San Quentin prison. And George Shibley played a very important role in the early phase of the trial. He was relentless in his attention to establishing a record that could then be used as the basis for the appeal. And I became fascinated by his tenacity and wondered why this Syrian-American young man who was soon to be drafted into the army, why he had worked so tirelessly on this campaign to defend and eventually free the young Mexican-American man. And I found that while there was some attention and in this very deep historiography of the Sleepy Lagoon murder case, there's some attention to his place in the story, there was also this really frustrating kind of erasure. And I also encountered that erasure in the voluminous records of the Sleepy Lagoon Defense Committee, which are housed at UCLA here in Los Angeles. And I think one of the reasons I made this commitment to use George Shibley really as the thread through this chapter is that I was interested in pushing against this erasure, and I knew that I had to keep him in focus if I wanted to sort of methodologically reclaim this piece of Arab American history within the larger history of Latino social movements in Los Angeles that were galvanized in these contexts of the race baiting of the Second World War. So the larger argument is indeed, as you've suggested, Joshua, is one of inter-ethnic coalition building and solidarity. And the decision to center George Shibley in the story really had to do with this methodological commitment to sort of restoring his place in a way, but would also argue for the importance of the Arab American history to social movement organizing in Los Angeles. So it's a thread that I pull through to the concluding chapters as well.
So going beyond a narrative of one man, you also talk about forms of cultural production, including sitcoms like the Danny Thomas Show. I guess another great man, I suppose. But there are others as well. These outdoor Maharajan festivals in the Southwest. These sort of cultural festivals for Syro-Lebanese migrants, especially. And this 1950s or the 40s and 50s generation, I think, has generally received much less attention historiographically than both the generations that preceded it and followed it. And you mention in the book, Edward Said himself wrote pretty dismissively of this generation as politically quiescent, assimilationist, and that sort of thing. But you push back against this a little bit. So what is going on with this sort of 40s and 50s generation, particularly in the realm of cultural production?
So there's a lot going on. And I think just to relate to an earlier question you posed, Joshua, around archival praxis in this book, I began to hear a lot in the oral histories that I was doing with families. I began to hear a lot about these Mahrajan, massive outdoor festivals. And again, it was an intergenerational story. So a granddaughter would be telling me about, how her father did the barbecue at a Mahrajan in near Griffith Park. And so it was very obvious that in terms of expressive culture, these outdoor festivals were very important for the Syrian American community in Southern California and more broadly in the Southwest. And it was frustrating, though, because there wasn't a lot of archival material. I would kept hoping that I would find more programs from the Mahrajans, but I really had to rely on secondary literature, including some really wonderful work by Anne Rasmussen, an ethnomusicologist who has a really amazing chapter in her dissertation on music in the, what she calls the middle period of the 40s and 50s. And so you asked me what was going on with this generation. A lot is going on in terms of cultural production. And I think what I was wanting to resist was this kind of unfortunate tendency to kind of write off this period as being not particularly important to Arab American history because we don't see it as a period of political activism, right? And there's even a tendency among the generation that sort of came of age in the 60s in a radical moment to talk about this earlier generation as being politically accommodating and quiescent. And I think there is some really interesting work to be done by the political scientists on this differentiation, but I was particularly interested in what I often call the fissures, right? In the places where that narrative begins to break. And it's not the same as arguing, oh, yes, the earlier generation of the 40s and 50s was radical, like the generation that came of age in Detroit in 67. It's not that they were the same. It's that there are continuities that I think are surprising and are worth probing so that we can extend this narrative of activism back and also bring forward the place of cultural production in the study of Arab American activism, right? So I argue in the chapter that there's this kind of slippage between the conventions that were more typically thought of as like political rallying points and the mahrajan, which were we tend to think of as being more party-like and festival-like, but there's actually a lot of organizational overlap. People attended both the conventions and also the mahrajan. And so I think as a closing statement to your question, I would just say that this is also another really exciting development in the historiography, is the newer attention to cultural production in the Arab American narrative beyond just literary production, right? So we have lots of work on literature of the Mahjar, but we have less on music, less on storytelling. And so I think it's just part of an exciting shift in the scholarship to different registers of expressive culture in Arab American community formation.
So your story then does pick up with a more, I think maybe traditionally activist generation, right? You do talk about that post-67 generation in particular. And you focus on third generation Arab American women in particular, relying, of course, on oral histories. But you also talk about what you call archival activism that some of your interlocutors undertake, a form of history telling outside of the academy. So what did you mean by archival activism? What is that?
So archival activism for me is a form of engaging politically with archival praxis. So seen in the constitution of an archive, even if you don't call it that. So if you collect your grandmother's letters and you don't know how to read them, and you decide, well, I think I'm going to have somebody help me decode and decipher these letters. That for me is a form of archival activism. If you then choose to use the knowledge that you're gleaning from these documents, these letters, to engage with history telling, right? Narrating your own history, narrating the history of your family. And this is a form of history telling that occurs outside of the academy, right? So I encountered this frequently in my research. I imagine that many people who are doing oral history research encounter this same phenomenon where their interlocutors, and in the case of the chapter that you're referring to, I'm in discussion with women who came of age in Southern California and often became attuned to their Arabness because they were engaged with the act of constituting family history, right? Collecting photographs, collecting the archival material of their family. The best case that I can think of here, and it's the way I begin the book, is to reference the story of Katrina Saadeh, who is the grandmother of one of my interlocutors, whose name is Kathy Saadeh Kenny. And she tells the story of how when her mother died here in Southern California, she went to a closet to begin to organize things, and she found this box of letters, right, that were written by her grandmother Katrina, but she couldn't read them because she couldn't read Arabic, and she wanted to know what they revealed, and so she embarked on this journey to have the letters translated, and she herself has written on that journey of discovery, and she has very graciously I'm speaking now of Kathy Saadekene. She has very graciously shared her material with me and with other scholars. So I think by archival activism, I'm identifying a praxis that, again, is outside a canonical repository. It's not at the Smithsonian. It's not at the IHRC in Minnesota. It's an archive that has come into being because of a feminist commitment to collecting and preserving the memory of female elders. So there's more I could say on that, but I think that's a good way to sum up what archival activism means for me.
I mean, I found this not only just methodologically interesting, of course, but just from a historical vantage point, I think it was interesting to read how, for your interlocutors, their activism on behalf of a number of what one might consider Arab American causes, right? Or you talk a bit about the questions of Palestine, you know, the first Gulf War, just as a couple of examples, that activism sort of comes out of this process of trying to understand and discover one's own history, and that, you know, it's sort of a mutually reinforcing endeavor. I think it gives, for me at least, the genesis of activism a new spin, right? It's one thing to say, and I'm sure that this is certainly the case, that, you know, hearing newsreels of 1967, for example, spurred people to action. There's been a lot of work on that, but this sort of activism seemed so much more personal, and I think that it was a really fascinating development or an intervention to make.
Thank you for saying that, Joshua. That's a really lovely way of saying it, mutually reinforcing. And I think, you know, there's a longstanding feminist tradition of arguing that the personal is a political. And I think sometimes we say, oh, you know, that's such an old cliche, but it's actually one that we can continue to return to and to probe in new ways. And so I think that this chapter, as you identified, is one in which I really try to sit with this emergence of a political commitment in the context, a political commitment to the question of Palestine. Many of my interlocutors talk about going to Palestine as being this kind of catalytic event for them in their coming into being as Arabs, right? So it became impossible for me to understand their Arab Americanness without acknowledging the place of Palestine in that consciousness, but wanting to do so in such a way that I preserve this kind of intimate realm, right? The intimate realm of the personal, the conversations they had with their grandmothers, the conversations they wished they'd had with their grandmothers, right? Which is something different. But thank you for mentioning that mutual reinforcement. I'm gonna hold on to that if you don't mind.
Sure, absolutely. So one of the other concepts that you put forth in this book is the notion of Syrian Pacific. And your penultimate chapter is framed around a really interesting metaphor. It's around the concept of palimpsest, which, a word maybe somewhat unfamiliar to our listeners. It's not one that I use every day, certainly, but generally it's a document, and feel free to correct me here if I'm oversimplifying, but it's a document where the original meaning has been either erased or replaced with something else. And so you turn to photographs, oral histories, and a novel in this penultimate chapter, which, you know, ostensibly focus on one thing, but then you read them in a way that recovers or unsilences a Syrian Pacific, right, that would otherwise be effaced. Could you tell us a little bit about how you were able to read a Syrian Pacific into these sources?
Sure. So I had been working with this idea of the palimpsest for a while in relationship to a naturalization case involving George Chisholm. So you know that I've written in more extensively on a set of naturalization cases in which Syrians litigated their status as white persons in the early part of the 20th century, with cases really emerging in the national scene in the 1909, 1910. Those cases were all over the place. They were in the South. But the first case that generated a fair amount of press coverage was this case of George Chisholm in Los Angeles. It was heard at the Superior Court. And I had looked at the documentation that was available and was very struck by what were marginalia, what were these obvious notations that were hard to decipher because the documents had been placed on top of each other and then digitized. So there was this sort of literal palimpsest I was trying to read underneath from one layer to the next, right, which is the traditional way we think of the palimpsest. But I was also increasingly interested in how the idea of a palimpsest could work metaphorically for understanding the different layers of the racialization process, right, in Southern California as they related to Syrians. And so it went from being this concern with how can I read this document more, quote unquote, accurately, right, if I can kind of detect what's underneath, to thinking about where else am I going to encounter the palimpsestic, right, palimpsestic. And I encountered it in a lot of places. You can find it on census records where notations are erased, scratched over. My favorite one is the census entry on manuscript censuses of for the category race, where you can see that Syrians have been categorized as O for other, but it has been erased, crossed out, and a W has been placed on top of it. So that for me is the palimpsest operating, right? And we have to not see that as a correction, but as a kind of layering and a budding up of different regimes of race, right, in this one document, a manuscript census. So I think, again, it's an sort of contribution. Using the concept of the palimpsest is a contribution to a conversation on what other conceptual categories can be useful for us as historians of migration, particularly if we're committed to, as I said earlier, moving away from these older longstanding metaphors, the botanical metaphors, the aquatic metaphors. So for me, palimpsest is productive for thinking through different layers of a spatial category, the Syrian Pacific, which I take from the literature produced by the Syrian American community in Los Angeles, particularly the guidebooks, which they produced very actively in the 20s and 30s and 40s, in which the identification of their geographical location was the Pacific, the Syrian Pacific. So, this is sort of an homage that I make in the final chapter to the ways in which the community themselves identified their location, both in terms of topography, but also in the realm of their imaginations.
So for our listeners who may have seen the a copy of the book, or at least the cover image, there's a palimpsest in there as well. Just I think that sort of speaks to the interesting way that you were able to use this metaphor, right? It has a picture of Muscle Beach, right? And some very impressive gymnastic feats. But you can see, if you look closer on the image, Khoury in Awad Cafe, right? And you talk in the book about how, although the focus of this image, right, of course, is Muscle Beach, but it can hide, unless one is looking for it, a broader Syrian community in Los Angeles.
Exactly. Yeah, I really appreciate that you reminded our listeners of the photograph. I do use it in the last chapter, the photograph of this cafe, the Khoury Cafe, again, as a sort of layering of this more iconic photo of Muscle Beach and the tumblers. I remember when I was in conversation with the production team at Stanford University Press about the cover, they asked me, what do you want to put on the cover? I said, oh, you know, I like black and white. I don't have a choice made right now. And then the designer came back with this one. And at first I was like, oh, okay. But the more I looked at it, it was just so beautifully designed, the cover. It was visually stunning, I thought. And it also really captured a broader conceptual move I'm making in the books around the palimpsest and the need to look at the layers of the Syrian American community in Southern California. And here we have the obvious one of the Khoury Cafe sort of setting the stage or being the backdrop for this, as I've said, iconic image of the muscled men at Muscle Beach.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about this book. As our listeners have heard over the course of this podcast, it's a really rich book full of both exciting anecdotes and a lot of really interesting analytical and methodological moves. I just want to ask now that this book is completed, have you thought about what new projects await you? What are you working on now?
Well, it's a tricky question, Joshua, because we're in very odd circumstances right now with the halt to so much activity because of the COVID pandemic. In a bit of a pause moment right now. I've been thinking a lot about my future projects because I put my file together for promotion at USC, and I sketched out for the university the projects that I'm working on. One of the ones that I think I want to turn to relatively quickly, and this involves me getting to Canada. I've for a long time been interested in my own family's trajectory towards activism on the question of Palestine. My parents were very involved in Palestine solidarity work in the 50s and 60s. And I've been interested in perhaps using the lens of this family story to look at synergies between the Canadian national movement and the Palestine solidarity movement. So it's a underdeveloped history, but basically looking at how activists who were arguing for the importance of the Canadianization of the university curriculum, for example, in the 60s, were also activists drawn to Palestine solidarity work. So looking at some of those synergies, and perhaps through the lens of my own family. But it's, it's in the early stages, but I do have to be in Canada to do that work. So hopefully I'll be able to travel by the fall.
Right. Well, it sounds like a fascinating project ahead, and hopefully hopefully when this lifts, it'll be something that you'll be able to pursue. Thank you again so much for sitting down with us, and to our listeners, we hope and pray that you will be well, and take care during these extremely difficult times. Thank you again, though, Professor, so much for being here with us today.
Oh, it's been a real honor, and thank you for being such a wonderful interviewer. These were great questions, Joshua. You take care, and I'm wishing you well, and good luck in your dissertation.
Thanks so much.